Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com. Welcome, everyone. My guest today is lead analyst Logan Modishami to talk about volatile mortgage rates in the wake of the inflation data and potential escalation of global conflicts. I'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Vesta, for making this episode possible. Logan, welcome back to the podcast. It is wonderful to be here, but I'm sad about the topic, which is mortgage rates and the fact that they might be going up.
Well, yes, today is a good day to talk about how high can mortgage rates go this year versus what we had to deal with last year. And I think, again, for me, it's always connect the dots. Everyone's model should kind of look the same until some variable changes. And when you're not a Fed pivot person like I am, going back to the late parts of 2022, I need to see the labor market breaking. That was the whole going on CNBC last year and saying the Fed wants to see the labor market break, breaking these jobless claims rise. They finally have come around to saying that in the presser in terms of, well, we watch jobless claims are falling. Well, if the labor market gets weaker, we'll act more. So even if they did three rate cuts this year, they're still, you know, restrictive policy based on what they said. And that's not me. This is not some market indicator. This is their own language. But now with the 10-year yield, 4.50 today, right as I speak, there's a little bit of a drama Friday morning. If the 10-year yield keeps on going higher to 5%, they said that was restrictive last year, okay? If they don't talk the market back down, then they were all full of it, right, the entire time. So now mortgage rates are acting better this year because the spreads are acting better. So in a sense, if the spreads do improve, you're not going to get 8% mortgage rates unless the 10-year yield goes noticeably higher from 5%. But I think now it's a good tug of war of, was the Fed lying about everything, about policy being too restrictive, or are they going to start to use different language? And I think this is where the macroeconomic data really kicks in, because if the economy was really going into a recession, everything we're talked about this last week with CPI inflation, everything and PPI and all that stuff, it doesn't really matter. The bond yields will go lower by itself, like they've shown, like they've done it in 2022. Even toward the end of last year, the 10-year yield was falling, but the 2-year yield, for everyone who's asking, we want our 5-year-old milks and cookies, right? The 2-year yield is a pricing mechanism of short-term rates. It's not exactly what the Fed does. So the 2-year yield was getting too accommodative. There are too many rate cuts. Now it's a really good tug of war right now, battle, because if bond yields go up, if mortgage rates go up, then the Fed would have to retract their statement last year by saying, "Oh, policy's too restrictive." All this with a 2 handle on PCE inflation on the 12 months. So this is the whole I'm not a Fed pivot person, because they don't look comfortable to me in terms of trying to pivot the market into a more accommodative stance. And when we talk about accommodative stance, we just go back to 2022, Sarah, when we said, look at what the Fed talked about. They want the Fed funds rate to mirror 3, 6, 12-month PCE. Well, that's like around a little bit under 3%. We're still at 5. We haven't even cut rates yet. So they are under restrictive policy based on that measure. And that's why they even talked about even cutting rates 2 to 3 times this year. It's because in their minds, they believe it's too restrictive when PCE inflation is at 2%, wage growth is slowing down.
So you and I talked after the CPI data came out on Wednesday, and you really felt like it had already, the market then had taken off the table one of the rate cuts. What's happened since Wednesday? We're doing this on Friday about midday. What's happened since Wednesday? And do you still think, yes, that's true, we're only going to get 2 rate cuts if things stay the same?
Well, the funny part is we had a very bad bond auction, and the 10-year yield went up a little bit higher after that, and bond yields have retraced back that move. So what's going on today? War, Iran, Israel, the stock market selling off. Bond yields were short-term, maybe oversold a little bit, so there was a catching a bid today. I would say not too much is happening in that regards. There's a lot of headlines. But when we broke that key level on that 10-year yield, look how volatile bond yields went up, right? You know, I mean, that CPI day, there was a lot of drama going up. That's not a normal 10-year yield day. So I just think we're now in a really good standoff between, was the Fed lying to us about, you know, restrictive policy? Do they just hold the ground and say, we'll cut 2 to 3 times, we're still restrictive? Or does the 10-year yield start to go higher and higher, questioning or challenging the Fed's restrictive stance where they have to come in? That's a tug of war. That's a fight, you know, and that, you know, again, 10-year yield, 30-year mortgage rate, that love dance couple, right? That's what matters. So as long as the economic data stays firm and we're in expansion and jobless claims aren't rising, it's really hard to get, you know, bond yields or mortgage rates down in that environment here, because I don't believe the Fed has pivoted. That's my whole, the Fed hasn't pivoted stance. When the Fed pivots, trust me, it'll be so easy. They'll be talking about neutral policy. They'll be talking about, hey, we're going to do things to help the economy. They'll even say, we believe we need to have lower mortgage rates to help the housing market.
Right.
Something they have never talked about, you know, for well over 2 years now.
It's interesting because we are seeing, you and I have talked about, you know, at what point will it bubble up from Main Street to DC, where people there are like, you know, housing, I mean, we know housing's been in a recession for more than 2 years. You made that call in 2022. Was it June?
June 5th, 2022, 5:01 p.m. And remember when we talk about the fifth recession red flag, home sales collapse, jobs have gone off the marketplace, and incomes have fallen. That's the existing home sales market. The existing home sales market for the economics is a transfer of commission. What really matters for economic cycles is, well, housing permits were starting to fall, new home sales were starting to fall, building permits were starting to fall, and then everything stopped on November 9th, 2022 in that regards. Now, building permits, single family permits, new home sales were rising, but also the building permits are in a recession right now. That's the thing. 2/3 of the housing market is now still technically in a recession. The construction workers are still being employed as they finish those projects, but the apartment construction workers, once those jobs are done, I don't see them going into the single family. I see those people losing that jobs. The remodeling part of the residential construction is big, and that's still working, but we still don't see a decline in residential construction that ties with every economic cycle we've had post-World War II.
Because once we lose those jobs, because it's such a big sector, then we're going to see the job loss recession at least be
Yes, exactly. You see the jobless claims start to rise, right? Because Fed raises rates, what sector gets hit? Where's housing, right? So when the job losses come in that area, there's your jobless claims rising continuously. And then the spillover effect, and every economic cycle runs into a recession. This is why people say housing leads to recession. But only 2/3 are in right now. And the backlog of homes, whether it's apartments or single family, which is big, is keeping these people employed. Where normally in other times you would have seen some losses already. So that's the reality of the world we're in right now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I feel like we've been saying that for a couple of years, that the backlog, because, okay, we got a backlog in COVID because you just didn't have a lot of supply, right? You had those supply chain things that got interrupted. But haven't we been saying that for 2 years?
They're going to do it very slow, Sarah. They are just, what do we wrote about this like in 2021. The builders will manage their supply. They are not going to shove inventory into the market. They are here to protect profit margins. Why? Why, Sarah? Why? Why? What do we say about the builders? They are not the
March of Dimes. That's what you say about the builders.
Yes, they are not the March of Dimes. They're not here to build for the society. They're here to make money. Come on. You think they're going to flood a market with single value? I mean, first of all, we couldn't even build homes that fast anyway. But in reality sense, they're here and just managing there.
For those of you watching us on YouTube, Logan's newest cat.
This is the stray cat, by the way, that is actually making me, you know, sniff my nose. This is Remy. He's a stray cat. He's 5 years old. We took him in and we adopted him. So let me take him away for a second.
Okay, we will have a short break. This short commercial break where we wait for Logan to come back from taking his cat. Also, I want to say thank you to our listeners who supported me on the whole talk to me like I'm 5 years old. And even though Logan was like, oh, milk and cookies, many of you let me know and let him know that you appreciated me pushing him to get him to a different kind of explanation, a more thorough explanation. So I feel justified. So we'll keep that going.
Oh, stray cats.
Stray cats. I just told the audience that I appreciated their support when so many people let me know that they were glad that I had said, you know, explain it like I'm five. And, you know, they came to my defense when you said milk and cookies.
It's correct. You're supposed to explain things. I just think the bond market is complicated enough already. And we try to like keep this as simple as possible. And it's hard, and it's easier to do it if I had visuals. Like this is why I love my live presentations. I got my charts with me. This is my armies, you know? So talking about it verbally is somewhat a little bit more complicated because it's a complicated topic.
It is. Okay, so let's get back to, we were talking about the builders, how they're very, you know, they're very controlled on what they do. So, I was saying, you know, we were wondering when it was going to bubble up to Main Street. And it has now. I mean, we really see that like people are feeling the, you know, people in housing, but also people just trying to buy homes. You see a lot of dissatisfaction. You see the Biden administration in many ways trying to figure out how they can do this. So, you know, we're gonna do some things on student loans. He has, you know, a policy for first time home buyers. We see, you know, the whole thing on title insurance, all these different things. What we haven't seen is any incentives to builders.
You know, there's actually a Supreme Court case right now that's going to be heard where the builders are actually sued, like the state of California, because they placed a huge cost hit on them for building any homes that they have to fund the local projects. That's really the only thing that I've seen that maybe could reduce the cost. And that's only in California. In California, we're not in the business of building single family homes or anything like that in a very big fashion. Supply, the reality is, Sarah, is that the builders will not overbuild ever. You know, they only build on their demand curve, even during the housing bubble years. And I think this is a good topic for everyone. The reason we had all those housing starts is because new home sales were growing. So you could have the spec building of the builders go up higher. But without that, there's a natural equilibrium with new home sales and single family starts and permits, and they have to work together. And it's a business model. We wrote that in 2021, that whole article about outlining five decades of work here. And the builders, remember, their competition is the existing home sales market. It's massive. It's huge, right? If more supply comes from there, that's more competition for them. In this environment, this is a once kind of in a lifetime environment where total active inventory hit all-time lows once in a lifetime. Then mortgage rates spiked up in the biggest fashion in very short terms, but the builders have enough profit margins to lower their rates and sell more products and build more homes slowly, right? But don't ever look for them to ever oversupply a marketplace, because right now, even today, there's only 85,000 new homes available for sale that are completed, right? So things that are probably going to go into contract soon anyway, but that's not the avenue. If you had a constant building cycle where you'd never stop, then you could actually build more supply. But we've already seen it. The builders' permits for apartments are at COVID-19 recession lows. It's headed toward the great financial recession lows if the trend continues, right? Why? Because they can't make money. Rates are too high. You can't cover the cost of building and making money. Nobody's going to do it. That's just the reality of the world. This is why some people say, well, higher rates are creating inflation. Well, in this context, it makes sense.
So, I mean, also just from a public policy standpoint and, you know, voter standpoint, if you did do something to increase supply and people's home values went down, there would be an absolute revolt in the streets, because we all talk about, like, this is how you build wealth. Well, that only happens if you sort of suppress supply at some point. Otherwise, you know, you know, if everyone's home values went down a significant amount because we had so much supply, people wouldn't be happy about that either.
Well, it goes into this theory that, you know, if everybody looked at home prices, how it gained since 1942, it's actually really rare in history to have nominal home price declines. If you exclude the housing bubble crash out of the equation, those 3 years, which was credit boom and credit bust, that's different. In this context, it's almost like, in a sense, a social contract, you know, that, you know, people have, well, we buy a home, the home value doesn't crash, and we have this saved, or what we call the forced savings, right? Every month you pay a little principal. Even if the home does not appreciate anything much, you create savings. But in a sense, that goes down if home prices crash. So it is kind of like a quiet contract that we have in America that, you know, they will keep inflating home prices because so much of the net wealth. And I talked about this actually on Yahoo yesterday with the NAR lawsuit. A lot of buyers have funded their home purchases through having the seller pay their buyer's commission, because there's trillions of dollars that have been created in the housing market. And that's kind of been a quiet, nobody really wants to say it for the last 20 or 30 years. It's only coming up right now because they're changing the commission patterns. But the buyers have benefited from that kind of equity buildup in home values.
No, absolutely. It's so ironic because I'm in a new build neighborhood and I just had to mute myself because the concrete truck just went by, right? The cement truck just went by. I'm constantly, you know, there's all these things. I'm seeing a house being built right now. So you know, I'm part of the ecosystem as a consumer. All right. So let's talk about inventory. We've had some, you know, not last week because of Easter, but we've had some gains, small gains in inventory. What do you expect for this weekend?
So we should get a bump by this time this podcast comes out. We're going to get a bump in inventory. Again, seasonalities of weekly inventory can go down and up. So you see the rebound. But now that rates are higher and we're in spring, I'm hoping, right, in the next few months, I don't bat a constant zero. All I'm looking for is 11 to 17,000 weekly active inventory growth with higher rates. Now, technically, we're kind of right at that 7.25, kind of in that range now. So spring is coming. I love the fact that inventory is growing year over year, but we also have to be mindful is that last year inventory was falling all the way until like April 14th, 16th. So it's a very low bar. But if you look at the growth rate of inventory, it's actually been very slow this year, but it's positive on a year-over-year basis. That's the good thing. That's the positive story of 2024. We're growing inventory year-over-year. New listings data is growing year-over-year. But again, context is key. 2023 was the lowest levels ever recorded in history of America. So low bar bounces. So I'm hoping we get a little bit more growth on the new listing side and a little bit more growth on the active inventory side as the spring comes. So this is the time frame where we should start to see the active inventory growth. If it does not happen again this year, where we don't have any weeks between 11 to 17,000, I have to rethink some things for my own work, because this is happening with higher rates. And what we've always seen, whenever rates fall and mortgage demand picks up, right, that first time home buyer comes into play, they buy a house, they don't give you an inventory. If most sellers are buyers, you see that equilibrium, right? That's the supply and demand equilibrium we've always talked about with housing. You think about it in that way, it does explain why inventory has been falling for many years, because everything changed after 2010 with the qualified mortgage rule, something we've never had to deal with in previous decades. But now it is, and now we have 14 years of data showing us one trend. The only time we've really seen inventory grow at all, really, after this law has been put into place, 2013, 14, with rates on higher, 2022, when rates went up so much so fast. The slope of the inventory curve was fast. Here, rates are high. Demand is, you know, mortgage demand is still very low. So we're not seeing the declines in inventory. We're seeing growth. So we'll see how the rest of the year goes. But we should get an easy bounce because of what happened in Easter. And this happens all the time with weekly data. The holidays or school starting or something like that to that nature. Even Christmas, New Year's Eve, you know, those kind of things impact weekly data. That's why we like to take averages and kind of take a look at everything and look at it in scale terms.
You know, when you first started writing for a Housing Wire in 2020, you wrote a lot about demographics. Of course, you were writing before that on your own. So you said a lot about demographics, but starting in 2020, and you had outlined and identified the years 2020 to 2024 as being very important from a demographic standpoint. And my question to you now is, looking at the way things have unfolded with mortgage rates and, you know, sort of throwing things off track, first with the pandemic and now with that crazy volatile mortgage rates, do you think there is, you know, what happens in 2025, 2026, or is there some demographic pent up demand?
Well, here's the thing. That model is a very simple one. Going back 10 years, people rent, they date, they mate, they get married 3.5 years after marriage, they have kids. Years 2020 to 2024, that's the biggest housing demographic. You get a little bit of bounce, right? Because we have very healthy replacement buyers. So you get that demographic kick just right there. What's occurred is we never actually had like a sales boom or anything, but home prices escalated out of my 23 price growth model, and then rates went up so much, so demand collapsed, right? Sales collapsed. So to me, this is kind of how I'm telling people, we're missing about 4.2 to 4.7 million home buyers that would have been here. To take about 1.3 to 1.6 per year. You know, that's kind of how you kind of want to get there. So because of that, they're still there. Those bodies are still alive. Right? It's just the affordability issue knocked them out. So the 2020 to 2024 has that missing buyer. I don't ever really believe in the pent-up demand. I've never even liked that theory. But in this case, we've retracted some buyers due to affordability, and those people are still there. When rates fall, and we've seen this at the end of 2022 and end of 2023, even getting down just to 6 to 6.5%, we see demand pick up. So assume hypothetical, let's say 4.75 to 5.875 mortgage rates for 2 years, duration does not go anywhere under or over. What do you think happens? Those live bodies get to buy some homes, right? So I think that's how I'm looking at here, the adjustments made after the crazy 5-year period of 2020 to 2024. And now that, you know, we saw this, you know, 2-month bounce in home sales, when you're working from such low levels, you could bounce home sales, but it still meant that mortgage rates go lower, demand picks up, sales grow, right? The levels of sales where we are, where is affordability, has a lot to do with how the future looks. But it's been evidenced 2013, 14, 18, 19, 2020, 2022, 20, whenever rates fall, you get that demand pickup. In this case, we're working from the lowest levels ever recorded in history. So take the bounces with a little bit of context, and then always think lower rates for a longer period and duration really impacts housing. We saw that in the previous decade. Rates ranged between 3.25% and 5%. Sale levels were elevated from where we are here today. Here, you have an affordability issue, but again, longer time and a lower period, you get more buyers into the mix. Sales grow. As every 1% falls down, the buyer pool picks up. It gets bigger and bigger. That's how people should look at it. That's how I'm looking at, you know, now that 2024 is going to be gone soon. That's my future model going out. The missing buyers, what happens in there for these people that are holding up? And this is actually something that with my recent interview on CNBC, the anchors were telling me that the CEO of Restoration Hardware was saying, you know, man, we have a lot of people just waiting for rates to fall. You know, it's because the affordability makes it, you know, it's not so much giving up your low mortgage rate. It's the affordability gets better. You could qualify, right? That's the whole qualified mortgage was designed for this, to keep the whole housing market in check. That's a big thing going into 2025, but it all revolves around the 10-year yield. Right? The 10-year yield, that slow dance, that really moves the housing market more now than any other time in history, because We are all qualified mortgage home buyers, but cash buyers as a percentage has been growing this year just because demand has fallen. So a lot of those sellers that could be buyers, if they pay cash, right, that percentage can grow. And that's what we've seen in the recent data.
I just published an article by Selma Hepp, who you know, economist at CoreLogic. She was talking about foreclosures and the fact that foreclosures have ticked up, but we're still at the lowest levels since 1999. So yes, they went up, but it's not really something to worry about.
Dude, I don't know if you remember this. There was this famous podcaster that literally like a year or 2 years ago was saying foreclosures are up 700%.
I do remember that.
So all those live presentations, when I do that chart, I go, oh, hello. You see that little increase, the 700% increase in foreclosures right there. Everyone take your glasses out. That's too small. Too small. That's nothing. Right. So the charts are designed to give people visuals so it can make it very clear. You have to be extremely, I'm very careful, and I would scream this from the top of the world. You be very careful on percentage increases when things are working from the lowest levels ever recorded history. Okay, this is why I don't like using them. You don't see my work really talk about percentage increases. I like to use the nominal numbers and scale, because then if I really wanted to use his nominal scales, I'd go, hey, we got 335 million people now. This is not, you know, the 1800s where, you know, you have a lot of people. And a lot of people are still chasing too few homes, right? So be careful of percentage increases. I see this happens everywhere. People use these huge spreads. They're like, oh my God, inventory is skyrocketing. They're like, oh wow, it's still very low. Yes, it is. Use the nominal data adjusted to the population. It makes more sense that way.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I was, you know, when you mentioned the fact that we have those qualified mortgage rules, this is why we don't have, you know, this rush of foreclosures right now. You know, you do see like they don't call it foreclosure. What's it called? When repossession, things like that. You know, people defaulting on different kinds of loans. But you're not going to see that in housing, because the people mostly who got loans under the QM laws, you know, they're able to afford their house.
So this is why I like to use the New York Fed foreclosure data. And it's just so clear. I mean, you even if you didn't have the ability to read, if you can visually see and you have a second grade education, it basically tells you the story. What happened in 2005, 6, 7, and 8 is people were filing for foreclosures and bankruptcies before the job loss recession, then the job loss recession. Here, none of this action has been happening for 14 years, right? So even if you didn't have the capacity to read, if you could just visually see the charts, you could see nothing is happening. Right. And again, there's a whole group of pathological lying, crazy people in this country who basically doom porn, and they take stories out of context for attention. They don't really believe it either. Right. So my job is to just basically show you the data. And I want you, as a human being, an educated person who could read and write. Right. You could look at that and go, wait, that doesn't look like a big deal. Oh, my God. You're right. They make it a big deal. Right. So when a job loss recession happens, 323,000 4-week moving average, guys, we've been doing this for since 2022. Look what happened. There's no recession yet. When that occurs, then you'll see a 30-day link. Then you see a 60-day. Then you see a 90-day. Then 120-day. Then a notice of default. Then you go into the whole legal procedure. Some states are longer than others. You're looking minimum, I would say, 9 to 18 months minimum before that supply hits the marketplace. In some cases, it's 3 to 4 years. Okay. This is not that marketplace, because people were filing for bankruptcies and foreclosures before the job loss recession. We're back to old school traditional lending, credit risk. And that means unless you do this for a living, you wouldn't know what that means, in a sense. So that's why I'd like to bring those charts, because all I know is when people see them, they go, oh my God. I say, yeah. Oh yeah. Don't you love this kind of action? Huge difference now.
So we just have a few minutes, but I did want, you touched on it earlier. So we've had conflicts, we've had some wars going on. We've had, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We've had the Gaza war with Israel. But we do see some new things coming in. It's one of those variables you talk about when it comes to what can influence the 10-year yield, which influences mortgage rates. So from your perspective, what is the outlook there as far as how much it could, you know, how long?
Okay, so here's one thing. War comes in, people put money in the dollar, and people put money in the bond market, okay? So the quality, safety, right? So the US dollar is still hanging in there very well. It's a little bit too strong for my taste, but still. 10-year yield, money goes into the US bonds. The US is the Godzilla of the economy and safety. So that is a short-term thing. If you're talking about a long-term consequences, we did that podcast a few weeks ago, where war is very inflationary in the sense that if it can restrict supply or production of supply or goods or anything in that matter, that's why World War I and II are very inflationary periods of times. That is something that has to like protract out into a long-term thing. That's a different conversation to have later on. We are in a protracted world war or something of that nature. But for the short term, you know, you could get, you know, money going into the 10-year yield like Friday. You know, I can make a case that today's bond yield rally is some of that has to do with, you know, the talk about Iran getting ready to attack Israel. The dollar is getting stronger because of that. That's a very short term thing. The long term implication of inflation and rates and war, that's we went over that in that podcast, where you can make a case that you could have 1970s inflation if war protracts around the world and you have this conflict, energy prices, diesel. And always remember, we always think about energy, but diesel costs for food prices, stuff like that, those things matter. But that's more of a protracted war event. Right now, it's just a very short-term thing. Money goes into bonds, rates get better, the dollar gets stronger. Stuff like that is very short-term versus a long-term protracted war.
Well, I appreciate your comments there. Thanks for answering that. And thanks for being on. Would point our audience to the Tracker article, which we always publish on Saturday. It has a lot of detail about what's going on, and especially the very latest inventory numbers. So, Logan, thanks again for being on.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to take a minute to rate the show and leave a comment. And make sure to tune in tomorrow for more news and insight.